once more into the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and...
Jake.
McClure. And at this point, I'm supposed to tell you that The Personal Wealth Coach is not only a riveting, as in very painful and hot, radio program, it's also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm domiciled in Salado, Texas, that does wealth management and such as that. I also need to tell you that we don't give investment, even though we are an investment advisory firm, and the two guys here are the same two guys who are the principals of the firm. We're not giving investment advice in this radio program. Instead, what we're giving out is education, which is different, and they have different definitions and such as that. And the information that we present here is information we have obtained from sources we believe to be reliable, although they're getting fewer and fewer of those. You know, we think it's right, but there's no guarantee or warranty it's right. And the stuff we talk about, stuff is a technical term, I know.
Yeah, stuff.
That is our opinion and our position, and does not necessarily reflect anything to do with Town Square or KTEM. And the telephone number to call in here, this is important. If today is the 29th of September, where you are, of 2018, is 254-773-1400, and we have a caller on 254-773-1400. So, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach.
Yes, sir. Thank you for allowing me to be on the air to talk to you, sir. This would most likely be an educational part of the show, of a question that I would like to ask, and get it out of the way so y'all can go on with more important issues.
Education's pretty important.
Yes, sir, but this one here might not be too important. It's just my behalf on what I want to know. You know, when a currency was in its embryo state, you know, back in a long time ago, you know, when people, you know, would say, look, you know, I got three sheep, I'll trade you these three sheep for your cow, you know, just things like that.
Mm-hmm.
How did it come to about that somebody figured out, you know, we're going to stamp this coin's going to have value to it, and we're going to exchange this coin for anything of value? And as far as the United States has anything to do with it, how did they come about going through that same method on as far as, you know, currency and its value and its worth something? I realized gold was worth something back in them days. But listen, sir, I really enjoy listening to your program, and you have yourself a very good day, and thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. What's the baby stages from barter to currency? The Chinese, or the Chinese not in the same sense of what we would consider the Chinese today, as there have been a lot of changes over there. But in that
And there's
section,
a lot more Chinese today than there used to
yes,
be.
Yes, very much more Chinese than there used to be. Sometime around 1000 BC, still during the Stone Age, we're barely moving into the Metal Age, is the first time that metal currency was used. Now, cowrie shells were used for a long time before that, going back tens of thousands of years. But cowrie shells were limited in supply enough that the sheep for the cow was a much more regular purchase than I have a handful of cowrie shells. The reason why metal coins started being used is because metal in the Stone Age, as you would think, because it's called the Stone Age, was rare. And the people that could take a little, could take a lot of rocks and refine that down into some type of metal, whether that's copper or bronze or gold, those were some of the early ones that were being used, because gold's easy to refine. Comparatively, copper is easy to refine, but it's still rare enough that people could say this is easier to carry than sheep. So the concept here kind of jumped forward about 600 or 800 years, and you get into the Roman Republic. We're not into the Empire stage yet, and the Republic was the one that really made popular using stamped coins as currency. In fact, the word defacing currency comes from removing the face of the coin. You know, whoever's on the front would have been in. They were called imperators at the time. Those are people that basically a one-year dictatorship that the head of the Senate of Rome could take over, and their face got printed on coins, and sometimes their mother's face is a kind of interesting area. So this idea of defacing currency, originally coins were based in valuable metal, like gold or silver or electrum or bronze, a lot of these different things. And over time, once the Roman Empire was good and fully developed, they stopped using pure metals. It was simply the face that was stamped on the coin that made it worthwhile, which made it really important to make sure nobody was stamping that face on coins where it wasn't allowed. So defacing currency or counterfeiting, that counterfeit means the opposite of fitting. So basically you take one coin and you press it into some wax, and that's the counterfeit. You're making a mold out of it. So that had to be policed really thoroughly, and it was a death penalty at the time. If you were creating false currency, you would be crucified. So there's a lot of history here. Who first came up with it? Well, if you think about the number of times I'm going to put air quotes in here. It's hard to see air quotes on the radio, so just imagine them. First times. The number of first times. It's been repeated throughout history. When somebody makes a wooden chit at a as a coupon or a piece of paper that says, hey, you get a certain amount of value for this if you show up and hand this in at the store, that's a form of currency. And it's developed repeatedly because people want business. So business owners are generally the ones that started currency as we know it, and then governments came in and started regulating it, because otherwise you had currencies for every manufacturing facility and currency for, and it's kind of a little bit like reward points on your credit cards that are only good at specific locations. If you want to have a currency that's useful across an entire territory, it needs to have a governmental regulatory authority, and that's where we come forward to an independent government-appointed group that controls the amount of currency in circulation.
Some of them are government-appointed.
Yeah, the head of the Federal Reserve,
the chairman is.
The chairman and the chairman's assistant, and I think there's four other people on the board that are appointed by the president, mm-hmm. and the rest of them are the heads of different banks that are Federal Reserve banks. And they're the ones that are saying how much currency is in circulation right now and whether or not we should lower that amount or raise that amount to prevent inflation or deflation.
Well, while Jake was telling you that, I have a little different... This is Jeff. I have a little different take on it. And
you're taking money? Is that what you're saying? You have a different take on money?
Right.
Right.
You're talking about sheep for cows, and that makes sense. But if you're doing commerce over a longer distance, carrying four sheep with you over several miles,
you
or maybe 100 miles,
you would herd them.
Well, you can herd them, but carrying them on a ship, taking them with you, having the portable ability to transfer value is key to long distance and complex economic gatherings and trading of things.
Mm-hmm.
And matter of fact, you were talking about the Chinese using a metal currency, and they certainly did, but there's a lot of evidence that Cro-Magnon, tens of thousands of years ago in Europe, were using flint blanks.
Yeah.
There was some very, very high quality flint that was found in Eastern Europe, and it's found all over in the blanks, the things that are about the size of your hand. It could be a big spear point, or it could be made into a number of small arrowheads or
scrapers. Other tools.
It can be made into a lot of things. But the point is, there's a lot of those found when suddenly there was a fire or there was some kind of disaster, and Cro-Magnon, who are our ancestors, had to suddenly abandon a site. They find caches of these blanks.
Which is, just as a side note, the word cash came from this. It was originally from the catches on a boat, but cash is... So, go ahead.
They find these storehouses buried, these buried treasures of these...
Flint blanks.
Of these flint blanks, just like...
Same's true in North America. You can go up to New Mexico and see on the ground in national parks and so on, flint blanks from Central Texas, from a time when there was no industrialized transportation.
So one of the questions that comes up when we look at these flint blanks, and by the way, that's one of the ways you can tell a Cro-Magnon from a Neanderthal site, is the Neanderthals did not have the blanks. They made all their tools and their points and everything out of local flint. Cro-Magnon, our ancestors, who were smaller and had smaller craniums and had lots of disadvantages, and you think they're going to get beat by the Neanderthals,
heftier,
but it worked the
stronger,
other way around.
Yeah.
So the Cro-Magnons were weaker.
Yeah. Yeah. You said the Neanderthals, yeah, who were heftier and stronger.
And the point is that it's a good hypothesis, and I think it's a very good hypothesis, that these blanks were... Why were these blanks not made into stone tools? I mean, they were their ideal material to make into the ideal tools that would hold their edges and be better than the local. But they would often make their arrowheads and their scrapers and their knives of local flint while retaining these high-quality flint blanks. And the conclusion, finally, was it's money.
Yeah.
They were uniform in size. They were uniform in quality. And they basically could be used to trade. So instead of having three sheep for a cow or four sheep for a cow, you have so many flint blanks that equal a sheep that equal, and so many more that equal a cow.
Right.
And then that concept continued to progress through time, and the idea of coinage, to coin something means to copy it, basically. And so the various societies began to come up with coinage where you could, instead of carrying around a clutch of chickens, you could carry around a pocket full of coins.
Mm-hmm.
And we progressed. And there's the second thing, and this is evidence. By the way, Jake, for example, for a while was really enamored with the fact that Roman soldiers, when they would go off to war, or they would be in their home farm or something, and they'd call to go to war or something, would bury a cache again.
Yeah. It wasn't home farm. They'd be paid right, and then before a battle, they would go and
they would go bury
it. And if
that was their savings account.
Yeah. Eastern Europe is full of buried Roman coins. They're laid out all over, and
they're not individual coins buried. There's just bags of coins, which have since sort of rotted away. But they've got these clusters of coins, and so the issue is, money then became a form of easily transportable value that could be exchanged for something without carrying around chickens or cows or chicken or sheep, and it also became a store of wealth, which is what it is today.
Yeah.
And the Romans were the first people, as far as we can tell in history, to stop using rare metals, because the price of the rare metal, the value of the rare metal, would go up and down as with discoveries of more rare metal, like gold.
And just throw in a side note here. The Greeks were still in that pure metal stage. Athens was under siege by Sparta. Sparta had by far the stronger military. Athens discovered a big silver mine and was able to buy a fleet of ships from the Turks, in essence, from the Ottoman Empire. Or not the Ottoman Empire, the Turkish Empire. What? My goodness, my brain just went blank on the name of the empire. Anyway, they bought a fleet of ships and were able to evacuate...
I think it was actually the Persian Empire.
Persian Empire, yes. I'm sorry, because they covered Turkey at the time. Yeah. Okay, so...
Gravy normally covers Turkey.
Yes, and I'm very
and
sorry.
Greece.
I'm
and
getting,
Greece.
Greece and Greece covers Turkey, yes.
But this was Greece that we're talking about.
Yeah, so Athens was able to be completely evacuated while it was burning to the ground on this fleet. They came back and rebuilt Athens. The second time it was under siege, they didn't evacuate, but they were able to eat the whole time because they had a fleet of ships. If it was just based on the strength of the people, the Spartans would have won. But because it was based on the fluctuating value of different currencies, the Spartans lost.
And, to, you know, the Romans came up with this idea of making the denarius, that had no precious metal in it at all. It was simply a durable metal.
Usually bronze.
That was stamped with a picture of the emperor. And the Romans set a value for it, and they maintained that that was the value, and if you didn't like it, you could lose your head.
Yeah.
And,
it was crucifixion.
Well, but they basically held a constant value for the coin. They had the equivalent of the Federal Reserve.
Right.
The treasury was on Mons Juno, which means the mountain of Juno, the hill of Juno, which is where we get the term money.
Mons.
And yeah. And it really held up well for hundreds of years in Europe.
What's funny is it still has a value.
Right.
It's just antiquity value now.
But the new denarius today is the dollar. And by the way, the word dollar comes from the fact that when our country started, there was a standard for silver. And it was silver that was mined at Thaler, Austria, that was pure silver. It wasn't silver ore. It was just the closest thing you could get to pure silver that existed. And coins made from that pure silver had a distinct value. And by the way,
it'd be the same as somebody calling sterling, even though sterling has some copper in it. Pound sterling is really because of the mix rather than the name of the pound.
So, and we had, for a long time in the United States, of course, we had precious metals that we used as currency, but they're really lousy currency. And the reason they're lousy currency, once you get into a wide enough, as the Romans found, once you get into a wide enough economic area, as the Greeks noted and the Romans discovered, a discovery of a new deposit of gold. By the way, the discovery of a new deposit of gold put entirety of Europe in massive runaway inflation and a depression, because the Spanish, when the Spanish real was the kind of standard coin across Europe, and then the Spanish
piece of eight, it wasn't the real.
Well, they could break it into eight pieces,
right?
And they called them pieces of eight. But the point is that they discovered gold with the Incas, and they brought in lots and lots of gold, and they discovered how to get inflation by having more money than you had goods and services.
Right.
So we actually have the most stable currency in the world today, and it is composed not of paper, not of silver, not of gold, but of electronic signals. It's a cryptocurrency.
It's really not even composed of electronic signals. It's composed of our confidence, our psychological frame into
the
this
physical
electronic.
Form, the physical, if you want to call it form, is these digital signals that travel back and forth between computers.
Now, we have a caller on 773-1400. There's some other stuff I wanted to say on that subject, so don't want to leave it completely. But, caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, enjoy the show. I read in the Wall Street Journal that the Japanese economy has finally clawed its way back after 27 years, and I was just curious. I know they were, for many, many reasons, they were kind of stuck, and they lost a lot of ground in the 80s and 90s. I was just curious, has Japan done anything different recently and allowed the economy to come back? I'll hang up and listen to
you. All right. Appreciate it. Abe. Abe is there, and there are a lot of new changes. Do you want to throw in some stuff here?
Basically, you had a new prime minister, and he was able to get a solid majority of the representatives behind him to get him out of their stagnation of a gradually sinking, gradually depreciating currency and a gradually depreciating economy as people got older, and the population was shrinking. And it was really, they're headed downhill, but they were very stably headed downhill, so everybody liked that. And they had what's called the carry trade, where people would own yen because they were stable. But what he did was he basically directed their central bank to institute quantitative easing. I mean, it worked in the United States to get us out of a slump. And so he directed them to do it, and he got enough popularity behind it. He had to wage a political campaign to do it. And at the same time, he has gradually been winding down by direct action, very similar to the way Ben Bernanke did it. The long-term debts that have been holding their banking system in the pits. They had long-term non-performing debts, and in the interest of social stability, they didn't foreclose on these companies, and they didn't demand payment of the debts from companies that couldn't do it because they have nearly full employment in Japan, and this is a, and if you, basically, if you cause a company to collapse in Japan, you're going to have a lot of suicides, and that's not really politically acceptable.
Yeah.
So he figured out how to do it the way we did it, which is to go in and the government absorb the bad debts, sell them off at a discount, which, of course, raised their deficit. Their deficit, by the way, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Their national debt is like 132% of their GDP, which is roughly twice ours. And their economy is stable and their currency is stable. And they seem to be doing just fine with a absolutely phenomenally huge national debt. Now, admittedly,
this is as of 2014. So this is 4 years later. 33% of the population of Japan is above the age of 60.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that is a very, very old population.
And it is. It's a fact. Of course, now, they do have this advantage on their national debt in that it has a negative interest rate, which means people, in essence, are paying the government for the ability to loan the money to the government. That's sort of an unusual situation. It's also going on in Germany. Germany and Japan tend to parallel in a lot of things, as we noticed in World War II.
Yeah, as far as median age goes, Japan is number two in the world after Monaco. The median age, median just means right in the middle. It's not an average, but it's right in the middle.
It's an equal number of people older and equal,
right,
equal number of people younger.
46.9, we'll call it 47 years,
yeah,
old. Germany is 46.8.
So
it's very close.
But what's happening there is they have negative short-term interest rates in their government securities, which means that if you, let's just say you wanted to, if we had negative short-term interest rates in the United States, and let's say you wanted to buy a two-year treasury note from the federal government, and you paid $1,000 for it, they would promise you that 2 years from now you'd get back $980.
Right, and just to go back to the beginning here, let me throw, you said clawing back to what they were. The Nikkei just hit a record, and what that means is it has now finally passed where it was 27 years ago.
Yeah, what was the record?
I'd have to look it up.
It was interesting because 27 years ago, 20-some years ago...
That's when I started business with you, by the way, 27
the
years
Nikkei
ago.
The Nikkei was exactly 10 times the Dow,
yeah,
very consistently. Now it's one time the Dow, which means roughly... Which means that basically, relative to the United States Dow Jones Industrial Average, the Nikkei Stock Index has lost 90% of its value during this period of continued deflation, which is why you hear us very much fearing deflation. But basically, Abe was elected on the platform of, I'm going to do what Ben Bernanke did and get us out of this kind of permanent stag recession. They don't have inflation, they have deflation, but in the interest of stability, they didn't want to rock the boat. And he's rocking the boat a little bit, and it seems to be working very well.
Right.
And they're finally starting to crawl out of the hole, and it's pretty amazing. Interestingly enough, by the way, Abe came over and had a nice discussion with President Trump, and as a result, they don't have any significant tariffs. Again,
right,
on us.
Right.
Which, and if you remember 20 years ago.
More than that, but yeah.
The Japanese were the Chinese are today. We were taking over the world and...
It was more than 20... Yeah, we're talking about the 1980s.
Ago. Yeah, well, yeah. That was just 20 years ago.
Yeah, just 20 plus, almost 20. So
yeah,
closer
well,
to 40 than 20.
Well, it is. We're going back to the 80s regularly in congressional hearings.
Right, so might as well talk about where currencies
80s are
were,
today, you know, obviously. Yeah. And I was listening to 80s music when I was doing a workout the other day. They were playing 80s music, and I thought, what is there about the 1980s that suddenly...
Well, it's
maybe we have nostalgia for Ronald Reagan.
Right. Well, the Generation Xers, which, by the way, that Senate hearing is dealing with Generation Xers. The people that testified there are Generation X. are coming into positions of authority. And just like when I was a kid and we were watching the Christmas movies from your childhood, now my childhood seems to be the thing that is taking up the Christmas classic
music. The modern stuff.
Yes.
The modern stuff.
The modern, yes.
Ronald
modern.
Reagan.
Yeah.
So, it really boils down to the fact that there's a science to economics. Ben Bernanke demonstrated that science. And you can fight it all you want to, and people like to fight it. They like, let's go back to the gold standard, man. I am the idea of going back to the gold standard is so scary. Gold was clawing up at around $2,000 an ounce.
Now it's like
$1,200.
Yeah, it's just below $1,200.
And what that would have done had we been on the gold standard, it would have put us in a severe depression, as if a dollar was as it was worth 1/35th of an ounce of gold as it was in the quote good old days end quote, then what we would have seen is the dollar's value would have declined by about 40%. In other words, or the dollar. So,
yeah.
So did we really want to see a decline in the value of the dollar of 40% in a few years?
Massive inflation, because we've brought the
deflation.
Price. No, it's inflation. If the price comes down,
the value of the dollar going
right, you would have, it would take a lot more dollars to buy the same thing.
So it would be the equivalent of massive inflation. So, yeah, let's not even try to go there, because first off, there's not enough gold in the world. If you at $35 to the ounce, there's not enough gold in the world to replace all the dollars in the world.
Right, which is why we left the gold standard to begin with. When France was saying, hey, we're going to turn in all these dollars and we want you to replace it with gold and silver.
We didn't have enough.
Nixon said, we don't have enough to go around. We're getting off the gold standard. And that kind of comes forward to this point. You know, this is where I wanted to go. I mean, it's nice how we're combining the two calls. The gold standard, the combination of what is currency, in the 1600s was the first time that bank checks were being used. The Dutch started that, and they basically, if you think of a check, it's written on the name of the bank. It's in essence individual currency from the bank that other banks don't have to accept. It's true today. If you write a check, HEB, Safeway, they don't have to accept it if they don't want to. It's not common currency. They usually do accept it if it's a standard bank. But we think about currency today as only being electronic or only being the money with the faces on it. But we're still using bank currency, in essence, blanks. We still call it a blank check if it's empty, to say what things are. And to some extent with a credit card, that is a bank currency as well. Even though it's dealing with dollars, it doesn't have to be accepted at a store where the name of the paper currency on the top of it says this is legal
tender.
This is something that you can hand off, and it's regulated to say if they're not accepting this, then there's a problem. And there are people that don't accept cash. So, as a for instance, the vast majority of investment advisors, fiduciaries, won't accept cash for their fees. They'll accept a bank wire, or they'll accept a lot of other things, but cash is dangerous much more than it used to be.
And if you go into a brokerage house, stockbrokers, and you have cash and you want to use cash to buy stocks with, you just forget it isn't going to happen.
Right.
Run it through the bank, write them a check. And the reason is, of course, money laundering is the issue, and the government needs to control where the money goes and how to collect taxes on it.
And the reality of that is that on the cash side, the government lost the ability to prevent counterfeit on a large scale during the fall of the Soviet Union. The Russians just started. They had a lot of counterfeit presses in the Soviet Union, but they were controlled by the government.
The fall of Iran was the big one.
That was another one too. Yeah.
We literally gave them
printing presses
and paper that was identical to the paper that's used to print U.S. Currency, And so when the Iranian revolution occurred, they
followed the Shah.
They were printing $100 bills. And by the way, we could have said, okay, no more $100 bills, and that was seriously considered at the time, except for the fact it would have wrecked the Russian economy.
Right, because that's what was...
that's what they use. They still use as reserve.
Yeah.
Actually, counterfeiting has become very, very difficult now because of the changes that have been made to the currency. If you look at it, it's got a little silver thread in it. It's got lots of peculiarities to it,
and
you can shine an ultraviolet light on it and see things. The point is, literally, to counterfeit a $20 bill would cost you more than $20 per bill to make a good counterfeit. So people don't do it.
Yeah, so, well, they do. There's some that do.
Well, they do, but they make very poor counterfeit, and they bury it in
lots of stacks of others.
In stacks of other money. And it looks like we've got another call on 773-1400, so you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Really enjoyed the show. On the subject of currency, I heard a rumor,
Ooh, we love this.
Yeah.
Buy low, sell high.
well, we all know the U.S. dollar is the standard world currency.
Uh-huh.
And according to this rumor that I read this week, because of or maybe in retaliation for Trump policies, there's been discussions about possibly replacing the U.S. dollar.
Right. There's also been discussions about breeding pigs that could fly.
The reality, let me throw this in.
Just how unlikely or likely would this be? What would possible replacements be if it were to happen, and how would that affect the U.S.
Although we can answer,
market and economy?
That very, very simple. Zero,
right, well,
zero, zero.
right
well,
yeah.
Yeah. Well, that answers the question. Well, I think
thanks for taking my call, and
I really enjoyed the show.
Thanks for the call.
All right. There's some truth to this rumor in that the European Union leaders have been talking with the Chinese. They've talked to a lot of the Middle Eastern countries as well. It's not replacing the dollar. It's replacing how oil is priced.
Yeah, the Russians have been trying to do that for
years. And the Russians want to get involved in this. The European Union's only kind of dabbling in it. They really don't want to try because the only currency that's anywhere near, and it's not even that near, to the dollar as far as circulation is the euro. The problem is that the euro doesn't have a single entity that backs it. I know that's a weird statement because you can say, well, it's the European Union. No, it isn't, because there's the Eurozone inside the European Union that uses euros.
And
there's no constitution to back it.
Each nation in the European Union taxes individually. And it's like the states tax individually. But the United States of America has a federal income tax and can tax as much as they want, literally.
To back the value of the currency.
And so we have the currency of the United States is backed first. The first bulwark is the Federal Reserve. And the second one is the fact that the Treasury of the United States and the government of the United States represents the largest national economy in the world.
And there's another piece here.
And
in the Constitution, it says that we will honor our debts.
Right.
And one of our major debts is our currency.
And we have a system which works very, very well, by the way, where the Federal Reserve is independent of Congress and the president. They get the appointees go in there, but Congress can't tell the Federal Reserve, create lots of money so we can pay off our debts and we don't care how much inflation is.
They can tell them, but the Federal Reserve won't listen.
By law, they're required to maintain a stable value for the dollar, and they've stated what stable value equates to, which is 2% inflation. And so the whole world can look and say, here's what the value of the dollar is. And the other thing is, let's just say that collectively the world decided that the United States sucked, basically, and they wanted to use euros. The problem with the European Union would never allow that, because what would happen is the quantity of euros that would have to come in circulation around the world is approximately five times the quantity of euros that exist today.
Correct.
You can imagine, you're trying to run an economy that's like a herd of cats anyway, and only one in five of your euros are inside that economy, and four of the five are out somewhere else.
Which is what the dollar has got to deal with on a regular basis.
The problem, the issue with the dollar, and it's a good issue, It's a wonderful thing. The Chinese, for example, there's people always worried about, well, the Chinese are going to sell off all their dollar-denominated securities, which is
not
treasury.
A big deal. Yeah.
The point is, the Chinese currency is based on the value of the dollar. And when the Chinese go to buy raw materials, which they need to run their economy in Africa or elsewhere in Asia, they use dollars because there's just they don't allow the yuan, for example, to leave the country. And the point is that you have even Bitcoin, you know, when Bitcoin is priced, it's priced in dollars. It's not priced in bitcoins. So the dollar is so ubiquitous and so stable.
And this is a good one. What is the dollar priced in? It's priced in dollars.
Yes. Well, there's a number of indices, and we know how many euros and how many pounds sterling. But the bottom line to it is there's only one large enough, stable enough, and well-regulated enough currency on the planet to be the what is called the global reserve fund. The Chinese, who are probably among our least loved and least loving of nations in the world, maybe the Russians. The Russians and the Chinese both hold reserves in dollars.
Right.
They don't hold reserves in rubles and yuan. They hold reserves in dollars.
Yeah,
by the way, they don't hold much in the way of gold either.
And most of the countries in the world, and I say most because I haven't done a thorough enough to say all but one, they purchase back their own currency. On the exchanges, they buy back their own currencies.
With dollars.
With dollars. So we buy back our dollars with dollars as well. In fact, when, you know, earlier I said it's one of the debts of the United States is our currency. Our currency says that we will pay you $1 for every dollar that you have.
That's right.
And that's the way our currency works. It is until that confidence can be replaced, and if you just think about the stability of the European Union at the moment, when
or the lack thereof.
And lack thereof, or of China at the moment, or of Russia at the moment, none of those, even together, have the confidence for their own citizens to want that to be the only currency around. So until that changes,
speaking of dollars and currency,
got to play some commercials.
There are people who pay KTEM and Town Square Media to say things during our radio program, and we have got to allow them to say the things so that the electric bill can be paid in dollars.
Yes. So we're going to play those. If you'd like to join the conversation after the stop for commercials, the phone number in here to reach the Personal Wealth Coach is
254-773-1400.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and Jake McClure. You have the market commentary. We haven't touched that yet. You want to take that?
Well, what do we say? The S&P 500 was down 0.54% for the week. The Dow was down more, but still, year to date, it's up almost 9%, and from a year ago, it's up 15.66. Now, the interesting, if you've been following the one-year return of the S&P 500, it's gradually declining. And that'll happen as we go into the rest of the year, simply because we had a big run-up in the market right about the time of the election last year. And it's going to turn around and gradually come, or 2 years ago, and it's run up with the stock, it's run up with the tax cut. And the gains since then have been single-digit gains as opposed to double-digit gains. And so as a result, you're going to see the longer-term returns gradually deteriorate. Interesting point about the market. We did have a down market this week, and so the question is, why did the market decline during the week? It's really fairly simple. Nobody was surprised by the fact that the Federal Reserve raised interest rates by 0.25%. I don't think anybody was surprised that they indicated that they're going to raise again in December and probably three times next year. That will raise the short-term interbank lending rate overnight to about 3.25% if they do that. And if they raise it to 3.25%, and you look at the fact that the 10-year Treasury is only yielding just over 3%, that will create the dreaded inverted yield curve that means a recession will be around probably within about 18 months. So that, but nobody was surprised by that. What was surprising is this week we instituted tariffs on another $200 billion worth of Chinese goods and nobody goods. And I think a lot of people were hoping that wouldn't happen.
Yeah.
And that is, that's going to eat into profitability going forward. It's going to, and it is already starting to affect things like housing. And we got a caller on 773-1400. I want to talk about housing, too.
Yeah. Caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
You were talking about the, excuse me, the Fed raising interest rates. In the paper, they mentioned the Fed's raising the rates between two numbers. I thought it was like an even quarter point. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Good.
It is an even quarter point. It's just that they always stated as two different numbers, a low and a high.
Right.
Historically, the markets have, the papers have only reported the high number. And for some reason or other, they've gotten a lot more accurate, and now they're reporting the fact that it's between, it's a quarter point spread between two numbers.
This is the historical thing when the newspapers or the news report it and the number is being lowered, they typically say the lower number. Like, it's very normal to talk about what happened after the recession and during the recession when interest rates were lowered down to zero. Well, they were never technically at zero. They were at the point between 0 and 0.25%, which, I mean, when you're talking about a quarter of 1%, it's effectively zero. And when interest rates are raised, usually the media reports it as the top number. So at this point, we're talking about 2.25%. Well, this transition, there's a new bunch of journalists out there from the last time around. I mean, it's been a decade of since you know, lowering is going on, so they're trying to figure out which number is the best number to talk about.
2.125.
Yeah, 2.1. What are we supposed to say? This isn't a round number. What do we say? Is it 2%? Is it 2.25? What is it? And the reality is that when a bank goes to get a loan at this interest rate, which is what it is, it's the interbank lending rate. They get loans from other Federal Reserve banks if they don't have enough reserves on hand. Then there's a little bit of flexibility on what can be charged. It's not usually the lowest number. It's usually closer to the highest of those two numbers. So if back when it was 0 to 0.25%, banks getting a loan from another bank would generally be charged closer to the 0.25 than the zero.
And it's the key here is to recognize that inflation is running along the PCE index, which is the one that the Fed uses primarily, a personal consumption expenditure index, is the core value in there. It's 2.2 if you just look at the broad index, 2% if you just look at the core. Is running about the same as the interest rates that the Fed is charging. And by the way, they removed something from their statement. They removed a single word, accommodative. Up until now,
it's neutral now.
The interest rates have been accommodative, and they just removed that word. Actually, historically, the interbank rate should be about 25% higher than inflation, and it's running exactly at inflation. As I said, the key thing I think to remember here is the Fed has indicated that in order to balance out the economy, they're going to need to raise to about 3.25%, plus or minus half of a quarter, obviously, but we'll just use 3.25%. And if you look at this is why we look at the 10-year Treasury note and see what it did. And it got up to 3.1 early this week, and then with the announcement of the tariffs, it slipped back down to 3.05, and that doesn't sound like very much. But with the Fed raising rates and the 10-year Treasury dropping at the same time, that's an indicator. And it may not be a big indicator. It may be the beginning of a turnaround, or it may be just a blip. And the same thing happened with the stock market. The stock market took a dip this week, and it took a dip when the tariffs jumped up to $200 billion, and the president said he would go from a 10% tariff to a 25% tariff. If that happens, the bond market and the stock market are signaling we don't like that, and we kind of suspect that this will dig into the corporate earnings growth, which is what is driving the market right now, so and driving the economy. So this is one of those things to keep an eye on. I'm reasonably well convinced that the president believes that raising tariffs is good for the American economy, but I'm also reasonably well convinced that the people who actually are in the American economy don't necessarily agree with him. So yeah. We'll see what happens. It's a big experiment. It's a gigantic experiment. Run huge deficits, flush lots of money into the economy, which would tend to cause inflation, which causes interest rates to go up, which causes things to be more expensive. And this is the great irony. Excuse me for running on this, but there's a great irony here, and I have to point this out. The more tariffs get raised, the further down, the greater the dollar goes up. So the dollar's rising, which makes imports less expensive and our exports more expensive, which means people are buying fewer exports. And so the balance of trade, since tariffs have been imposed, steadily gotten worse and worse and worse.
And that's the metric that the president is using to enforce more tariffs, is not realizing that he's creating more of the problem that
right.
he was pointing at when he said it was a problem.
And fundamentally, if it isn't going to make the yuan and the Chinese, the value of the Chinese currency very happy, but the point is, as I mentioned earlier, the Chinese use dollars to buy stuff to import into China.
Right.
So the rising value of the dollar effectively is enriching the Chinese government. And the tariffs are causing the dollar to rise, which means you're really not hurting the Chinese except for the fact that you're making their products cheaper to sell and we buy more of them. I don't think he's got a degree in economics.
No, but, I mean, he's got business acumen.
Mm-hmm.
But this is one of the things we've talked about before, and this is important. When you're reporting on the economy and you're first getting started and you don't have a big say in the economy, you reporting has no effect on the economy. But once you get to a big enough level, reporting on the economy affects the economy. And when you're a businessman, even a billionaire, and you're doing deals, your deals may affect the economy a little bit. But when you're the president, your deals affect the economy a lot more. And what worked at a smaller level doesn't necessarily work at the larger level. And that's something that is a transitional thing. There's a learning curve that has to happen there. And it's the same in economics. If you get a microeconomist and a macroeconomist in the same room, before too long, you see fur flying. Because at the micro level, what happens is very different at the macro level. There are some premises that are the same, but there's some premises that are very, very different. And when you're doing trade between two companies, if you buy something back and forth, you have not a huge effect on the other company's trade. This is different here. We're about out of time for this hour. Do you have anything you want to wrap up this hour with before we give our numbers out and then go on?
Well,
to
I guess I think I can. Let me just one thing. The Trump administration has now officially acknowledged that global warming will raise the temperature of the Earth 3.5 degrees by the end of
Celsius.
The century.
Celsius.
Yeah,
7 degrees Fahrenheit. Yeah.
And will cause the oceans to rise. What was it? 96 centimeters.
Yeah,
76 centimeters.
And this is
and
the
I thought
Trump,
that was
this is the Trump administration.
Yeah,
saying.
I thought that was pretty interesting. In other words, let's go.
Yep. If you would like to contact us off the air, we do give personalized fiduciary advice to people of high net worth. Our phone number locally is
254-947-1111.
And toll free, it's 1-800-914-7526, 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com. You can email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. We read them and answer them. So until next hour, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.